All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Hey, guys, check it out. I got Tom Woods on the line. How you doing, Tom?
Hey, Scott, I didn't even have time to ask you, do you want me to record on my end?
Nah, I got it. It'll be fine.
All right, you're right. Good man.
You know, I used to interview you all the time, and then now you interview me all the time, and I haven't interviewed you in forever, so I'm so happy to have you here.
I know, and I thought, yeah, you know, I got all my girls home, I got all this stuff to do, but then I thought, my gosh, do I owe Scott Horton a favor or what? After all the times,
vice
with
versa.
10 minutes notice, he's come through for me on my show, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I'm happy to do it. So, and I'm happy to have you here. So listen, I've been going around all day with my different guests talking about the virus and getting these different kind of perspectives and things. And so I want to hear from you about this. But before I hear your take, I was wondering if you know if there is a definitive Rothbardian take on pandemics. I mean, the guy wrote a million things about a million things and seems to be our North Star on so much stuff. And I guess it must be that before my time, back when they were arguing about nuclear power and every other thing under the sun, that the libertarians must have really sussed out what are we to do in the midst of a viral pandemic, right?
No, and this is not my strength, by the way, but I don't believe so. The closest we've come, however, is Bob Murphy. And my feeling, maybe you agree with me on this, that if we can't have Rothbard, I will take Bob Murphy in a heartbeat.
Sounds good to me.
As a theorist on this. So I actually had him on back when Ebola was the issue.
Okay.
So I had him on years ago to talk about that specifically. And of course, the particulars are not that different. I mean, the issue is it's a pandemic. What do you do? So I'm on one of the few shows where the host makes me feel like a lazy bum because I've only done 1,600 some odd episodes. But episode 270 of the Tom Woods Show is a long time ago. So tomwoods.com/270 is Bob walking through exactly how it would work. The trouble is that what Bob's describing is a society where there's no state whatsoever and there's all a bunch of private property owners. Right. And so you figure, all right, I probably see where this is going, how private property owners would have an incentive to try to get a handle on this and figure out who's had it and who hasn't and
right.
who's coming and going and
but
all that.
We need ceteris paribus here.
Right. We need to know what would you do in the present situation where it's not just private property owners and where there's a state and where there is the potential for this to get bad. And that, you know, frankly, is still, to my mind, kind of a work in progress. I have the luxury of not being in charge of anything. So I can sit back in my armchair and mull this over. So I've been mulling it over. But as I've been mulling it over, I've been watching the news unfold about it and watching the way a pandemic has people divided, you know, like politically. Mm-hmm. So some people think a particular drug treatment is effective and some people don't. And whether you think it does or it doesn't depends on whether you like Trump or not. Like, what is that? Like, none of them know. Nobody talking about this knows anything.
Yeah.
Nobody knows anything except the doctors using it. And even they are just using it, you know, not in a clinical trial setting, but at least there's a lot of interesting anecdotal evidence about it. But it's like if you go on Twitter, and I have experience with this, and you publish something saying, hey, actually, well, this is great news. It looks like it's not as virulent as we thought. Or here's some great news. It turns out, blah, blah, blah. You know, and you come in with this great news. Or, you know, in Texas, it's not the hospitalization rate is not where we feared it would be. Or right. In North Carolina, no, there's not one model that shows them running out of ICU beds. Not one. Like, this is great news. And it's like they can't even take great news. Like, you say great news, and it's like you told them, I shot your dog, and I'm about to shoot your kids, too.
Yep. Other hand, you know, the libertarians, by and large, you know, we're all individuals here, but I get so much. How dare you be concerned about this at all? This is all government propaganda.
Oh,
they're trying to scare you, and all good libertarians are of one mind about this. It's no big deal.
Right. No, I know. And that is – there is a division of opinion among us on this. Now, Reason Magazine, I think, has actually been pretty sober about it. Mm-hmm. But I've seen people who are both extremely dismissive and extremely doomer. That's the okay boomer. Mm-hmm. I've gone into okay doomer.
I like
where
that.
They go for the worst possible outcome. Now, I do take it seriously, and you and I better not say the name. I'll tell you afterward. But you and I are close friends with somebody whose wife has a condition that he fears this virus could do serious damage to her, even kill her.
Yeah, that's and me. So, my wife. She's got the lupus.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention. Mm-hmm. Not to mention. Yeah, I was thinking of somebody. That wasn't an indirect way of saying
oh,
you.
Oh, okay.
So
that's
there are
okay.
A lot of people
I've mentioned that a few times, so it's all right.
Okay, but, yeah. People who have that had that fear. So mm-hmm. I totally get that, and I don't want to see people die unnecessarily. So I've not been of that opinion, but I've kind of evolved, and I know that maybe you've seen some of my posts or newsletter issues or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, I've actually listened to a couple of shows too, an interview
okay,
of
good.
You and a couple of interviews that you've done as well.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you know that I started off reading, you know, these really worst case scenarios, and I just couldn't see what the flaw was. So I would post it on Twitter and say, all right, all you people telling me I have nothing to worry about, show me where the flaw is in this paper, and then I'll agree with you. And so I was waiting and waiting for that. But as I was waiting, so in other words, as I'm sitting there in my armchair trying to think through how libertarians would deal with this, what I was actually doing was observing in real time this political phenomenon of people debating. And if somebody says something pessimistic, this means they're a Democrat. And if they're it's bizarre to me. And so at this point, I feel like. I think at this point, now that the numbers are being scaled back, now they're saying to us, oh, well, these models aren't supposed to be accurate. You know, they're supposed to change with new data. And now we've seen that everybody's doing a great job doing social distancing. So, of course, we're going to revise the numbers. But the models already assumed social distancing. They already assumed the schools would be closed, the businesses would be closed, and we'd be locked in our homes. Mm-hmm. They already assumed that. So it can't be, oh, we got this new data showing that you guys are really doing what we expected you to do already. That doesn't work. So as I see these numbers come down, and I hear these excuses that, oh, well, these models aren't supposed to be accurate. But, I feel like if you have a model, it's got to have a use.
Yeah.
The model has to be useful for something. And what is irritating me here is that, yeah, they did use the model for something. They use it to scare the hell out of everybody.
Right.
But then when I want to use it for something, when I say, all right, well, look, I want to have some expectation of what my immediate future is going to be and when I can plan to go back to not living like a vegetable anymore, then suddenly they say, no, the models are always evolving and changing. So the models can't be used for any practical thing except to scare the hell out of people.
Yeah.
What is this? And I am also wondering if, you know, up to now, there's been, like, the medical profession has been the closest we've had to a priesthood. Like, these people, you know, you bow down before them because they can heal the sick. And I mean, that's true. I mean, I have a lot of doctor friends and it's very impressive what they can do. But at the same time, I think this thing is going to make us realize that to some degree, it's been a bit of a bluff. There is an awful lot we don't know and a huge amount that we don't know
mm-hmm.
and probably much, much more that we don't know than we do know.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, into that, I kind of always just take the models with a grain of salt because you're talking about guessing the future and then with a math problem instead of a magic wand or a crystal ball. But the math is only as good as the garbage that you put into it. And, you know, I have a guy in my Reddit room. You know, you have your Facebook group. Well, I have my Reddit group. And I've got a guy in there, and he's been really a hawk on this stuff and just crunching the numbers all over the place and had a thing comparing the rates and of hospitalizations and ICUs and of deaths, and then trying to compare the different countries of who's had a lockdown and who hasn't. And maybe people are spreading it worse when they're locked down because now you got the young locked up with the old, and maybe it'd be better if they weren't, and these things. And then, but the answer is you can't find a real pattern in it all because the numbers that are going in and out are so different in every case. The different variables are so wide that there's no way to really crunch the number. Whether you're Stephen Hawking or anybody else, can't really figure out what, how to project what's happening in the future here, really. Well, at the same time, it does make sense that, on the face of it at least, you keep everybody apart. That'll keep the hospitals from being too overwhelmed at any one time, which is a real worry. You know, my sister's a nurse here in town, and this is something that they're taking very seriously. And I think they're very pleasantly surprised also to see that in Austin so far, it's 500 people have got it, and I think 50 dead. And in Williamson County, where I live, one county north of Austin, it's 2 dead so far. But they don't really know what the total numbers are because, in fact, as my sister told me, they have, you know, halls, you know, rooms full of people who they're virtually certain have COVID, but they don't have the tests. And so whether these people are living or dying, they're not being recorded. Or if they are, it's in more of kind of an ad hoc fashion because they just don't have the test to see. In fact, the lady that died in Williamson County 2 days ago, she'd been asking to be admitted for a week and they kept turning her away. You're not sick enough to even be tested. And by the time she was sick enough to be tested, she was dying and then she was dead. And so, you know, back to the data. How do you crunch that into an algorithm where you can guess what things are going to look like in June and when you have to take into account the weather and everything else? So who really knows? I don't know.
And then meanwhile, you've got people – see, again, I'm not a health expert. But the thing is, the health experts aren't experts on other related things that they would need to know if they were going to make policy. So a health expert can say, this is how we believe – this thing is transmitted from one person to another, which was not clear from the beginning. People didn't quite get. And then now, I was just reading today, they went through somebody's home who was infected. There wasn't one surface where they could find any evidence of this thing in anywhere in that house. So anyway, it's very mysterious. But the health person can tell us that. The health person cannot say, overall, the best approach is to lock everybody in their homes because there's collateral damage from that. That can't be calculated by a health expert. What qualification do they have to do that? Mm-hmm. So we have all these things to bear in mind, and I realize I'm not an expert in absolutely everything, but it does seem to me that eventually we're going to have to admit that the only approach that makes any sense in the long run, and that even all these patriots right now who are saying, I'm doing the patriotic thing by staying in my house, you make them stay in their houses 3 more weeks, they're going to be ready to murder somebody. So eventually – we're going to all have to admit that the only approach that makes sense is to voluntarily quarantine people who believe themselves to be especially vulnerable, and the rest of us do the best we can to cater to those people, provide them meals, take care of them as treatments continue to be developed and as we continue to observe how this thing goes. That is the only approach that we're going to have to adopt that approach at some point. The alternative is what I saw the other day, this Dr. Zeke Emanuel, who's the brother of Rahm Emanuel, saying that we have to be prepared to be locked down for 18 months. And he said, don't go to work, don't go to school, don't see your extended family, don't see your friends. That is what I mean, because we have no choice. Yeah. I'm not kidding you. Those are his words.
Although that's completely insane. Nuts, as you say. And, you know, I heard you mention this, the 18 months time frame in an interview that you did, or maybe it was an interview of you. And I've seen that a couple of times myself where they're saying that. But I just kind of completely reject that as being plausible, even to the other people in charge. I mean, they did say we're going to flatten this curve for a little while here until, hopefully we get our peak within by the end of this month, and we're on our way, hopefully by the middle of this month or something, we're on our way down the backside of the curve and we get, in 4 weeks max or something, you let people go back to work because it's just, to me, I'm just using my imagination and speculation here, I guess, but to me, it just seems that it's absolutely intolerable from the point of view of big business that they would be willing to stay locked down for this long, no matter how much welfare they're getting. I mean, they can see that systems are going to completely fall apart if people can't get back to work here soon. And then once we are allowed to go back out, then they're not going to be able to do a new clamp down. They're going to have to figure out a medicinal treatment or something, and soon. And you notice that this is what they're not doing, right? They're not saying, well, listen, our number one concern is that we're going to end up having to triage patients. Our hospitals are going to be overwhelmed, and we're going to have people dying in the hallways in the parking lots. So what's the solution to that? The first thing to do would be expand the number of hospital beds in all your major cities as fast as you can so that that doesn't happen. So you have at least hospital rooms to put them in right. as you try to catch up on the number of ventilators and things like this. But they're not doing that. And, you know, Trump said yesterday, no, we're not doing widespread testing. Well, yeah, but that's exactly what we need to do. In fact, I just talked to Christine Ahn, the great Korean peace activist, and she says in South Korea, this is how they beat it, was by testing everybody. And then that way they were able to isolate, I think voluntarily, the people who'd been exposed, and meanwhile let everybody else go about their lives. And she said they're going to restaurants to eat, they're visiting family, everything's all right. I read a thing in Hong Kong where it's all about the masks. They were all wearing masks anyway, and then their government encouraged them to wear masks even more. And now the only places where they're having outbreaks is where people go to like potluck dinners together and take their masks off, or some Buddhist religious ceremony or something. And that's where all the outbreaks are happening, are where people are breaking the common procedure. But that's what they need. They need beds and they need masks and they need the basic tools to protect themselves while still going about their lives. And that's what we're not doing at all. Rahm Emanuel's brother, I guess, is counting on, we're never going to have enough beds. We've got to use force to keep the curve flat from here on out.
Right. And so, you know, what makes sense for us to do at this point? I mean, as you say, the point of this lockdown was supposed to be to buy the healthcare system some time.
Right.
To cope. And so I asked the question, all right, anybody who follows me who works in a hospital, tell me what you've been doing. I mean, you're asking an enormous sacrifice from the public. Now, it's not to say healthcare providers aren't also making sacrifices. I mean, they are. They're right on the front lines. They're very brave to do this, and I'm not downplaying that. But on the other hand, you are asking people to suspend their hopes, dreams, and aspirations. You're destroying I mean, like, I'll just give you a quick example. Our friend Kevin Gutzman, who he wrote a book with me, Who Killed the Constitution. He got his PhD from the University of Virginia years and years and years ago. So his daughter is graduating from the University of Virginia. And he had dreamed for years of watching her walk down that same path he did, and how what sentimental value that would have. That's been taken from him because they've canceled that. Now, I know that is the tiniest speck of an inconvenience to the average person, but that, like, that meant everything to him. And you multiply that by billions, and yeah, portions of people's lives are being ripped away. So I sure as heck would hope that in the meantime, they are making revolutionary changes in these hospitals to justify this. And I did get some private notes from people saying, here's what we've done. We're doing this, we're doing this, we're doing this, we're retooling this, we're calling up this, whatever. I did get some people saying we are making serious moves. And I got other people saying we're twiddling our thumbs sitting around waiting.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, it's funny because it's already agreed upon what the problem is. And in fact, you know, it actually kind of solves itself, too, because people are so afraid of the coronavirus, they're not going to the hospital unless they absolutely have to. And I guess the hospitals themselves are putting off other procedures and that kind of thing. And so they're really slow. In some places, they're laying off workers because they don't have enough other work to do. But so it sounds like that's enough rooms then to solve the triage crisis that we've got. So there's that. I'm actually just can't help but troll Twitter here, and I'm seeing your tweets where you're saying, okay, well, if we're not flattening the curve and the curve's nowhere near spiking, then what is the rationalization for continuing on when that was supposedly the reason we were doing this in the first place?
Yeah, what I was asking was, in North Carolina, there was no model that showed them anywhere near getting in a position where they would have to make triage decisions and they'd run out of run out of ICU beds or whatever. They were not going to come anywhere near that, and they were shut down anyway. So then people said to me, well, there are some ancillary benefits to the flattening the curve social distancing strategy. It can actually have some other beneficial effects. okay, but then I read plenty of articles saying, no, social distancing and flattening the curve, this is going to just spread it out, but it's not going to cut down on the number of deaths. You don't know what to believe or what we're supposed to think. It's like the Iraq war, where they didn't say Saddam did 9/11, but they didn't actively discourage people from believing that. So the result was a totally confused messaging that whose net result was we demand more action, and the same thing here.
Hey, man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org.
Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver, is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. commoditydiscs.com, or just go to scotthorton.org/donate.
Hey guys, Scott Horton here for expanddesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and save $500.
So now, I was talking with Dan Lazar earlier about the crisis that they're having in the Navy, where they've got this massive outbreak on the USS Theodore Roosevelt. And then now there's news coming in, the Nimitz and the Ronald Reagan both have COVID cases. And it's been reported here and there about different battleships and this kind of thing. And then, of course, as you know, there was this huge controversy because the captain of the Roosevelt tried to stick up for his men and ended up getting fired over it. And then the Secretary of the Navy got fired over how he fired him and how he carried on about it. But what got him in trouble was he was saying to these sailors, do your damn job. You know what? If you were under fire, you'd still have to do your job. And so, yeah, germs are scary, but so what? You're in the Navy now, son. And so that's the deal. And so we're talking about that. And I had mentioned that there was an article saying, look, the military, these are all strapping young men. They can handle it. We ought to go ahead and encourage the spread of the disease inside the military so that they can develop herd immunity and get over it sooner, at least in the Navy. I'm not sure if they're referring to all armed forces or what. But so Dan Lazar says, well, listen, I mean, the deal is these guys have signed up to sacrifice their lives if necessary in war. But now you're asking them to sacrifice their lives for herd immunity. It's even if it's just one or two or three sailors per ship, that's a hell of a lot to ask somebody to essentially commit, suicide for, or, play Russian roulette over. But that's the same kind of problem that we face here, too, that, I was talking with Stockman earlier, and his position is, pshaw, this thing is hardly a danger at all to anybody under 50. And so anybody under 50 ought to be able to get back out there and go back to work. And of course, if you're sick for whatever other reason, you should stay home like an old person. But for everybody else, go for it. And then I guess, whatever people are going to go ahead and get sick and still die of it anyway, that's essentially a rounding error. And yet it's not if you're that person or that's somebody that you care about whose life has infinite value. It's not, I know the Chicago school guys like to put, and the liberals too, I know, do this where they assign a numerical, some kind of dollar value to a life or a year's worth of human productivity or whatever kind of thing. But, we don't believe that. We're libertarians. We believe every life is beyond price. And so, I don't know. I talked to Jeff Deist a minute ago and he was like, I don't know. I think if 1 million died, that still wouldn't be a justification for deliberately causing a Great Depression the way we're doing now. Although, it doesn't go without saying really that a Great Depression would kill 1 million people. I mean, that's twice as many died in the Civil War. It's pretty hard to say. And like you said, it's lucky neither of us are in charge as we try to figure this out. It's not up to us to really decide for anybody else. But to essentially say hands off, laissez-faire, is also risking people's lives, and especially right because this disease can be spread, unlike Ebola, this thing can be spread around when you don't even know you're sick. So you're going around saying hi to your friends and you're accidentally killing them. You're regressing, but you don't even know it until you find out later that, oh, I did that, you know?
Yeah, I know. It is hard. It is hard. And it's hard to know what, again, what the right thing to do is. But at the same time, I mean, the way I looked at it back in March was, okay, the world just got a little bit more dangerous for me. Not massively more dangerous, but a little bit more dangerous for me. Mm-hmm. And I just have to factor that in. So in like in a way, it's like the way George Riesman, who's an objectivist economist, the way he generally thinks about global warming. He says, all right, let's even assume everything is true. Since we cannot dismantle industrial civilization, and we will not do that, we will not go back to living like cavemen, we simply have to take this as something we have to live with, we have to adapt to, we have to move things around a bit or whatever. Now, obviously, he has a much more sophisticated view than that, but that's just the framework he's using. Mm-hmm. That was the way I looked at this. The world has become more dangerous. I have to adjust my behavior to some degree. And so I've now told this story several times. I apologize, but it is so significant to me to hear myself tell this story because it shows how quickly things changed. As recently as March 7th, I was in New York City having lunch with our friend Gene Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't shake his hand. He has a Japanese wife who was with us, and so we did the Japanese bow to each other. Mm-hmm. We had a very lovely lunch, and we were talking about the virus. And I said, I've got trips scheduled in May. I was going to have a trip to Scotland during your debates, why I couldn't come.
Right.
So whenever that's rescheduled, I'll be able to be there now because I ain't got no trip to Scotland no matter what. So I said, yeah, I got this trip to Scotland. And I got another trip to the UAE scheduled. And he was saying, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, assessing the situation, I think I still want to live my life. I think I still want to go. And he said, well, that's if I were your age, I would feel exactly that way. I think you should live your life. And so as I look back on that, it's amazing that we thought we were in a world where this was up to us to decide. We were going to assess the risk level, and then I was going to decide whether I went on the trip. I mean, I saw something by Larkin Rose the other day that I have to admit there's a certain logic to it. I don't want to sound flippant. I'm just thinking out loud here. And it basically boiled down to, if you're worried about the virus, stay home. If you're worried about it, stay home and you can't get hurt. Stay home. But you can't tell an entire society indefinitely with absolutely no end date given to them that they all have to stay home.
Right.
If they go out and live their lives, but you feel like out of an abundance of caution, to use a Donald Rumsfeld phrase, you need to stay home, stay home. Now, I have to say, Scott, I know that's callous, but there's a part of me that doesn't see the flaw in that.
Well, except, you know, again, you have people who they would stay home if they knew they were sick, but they don't know they're sick. And there was this story that the CDC had published, and I apologize, you got to look at the Daily Beast to read about it, or I guess you can read on the CDC website, where there's this guy they're calling the super spreader in Chicago, who went to a funeral and then went to the after party and then went to dinner, and he killed, I forget, two or four people and got dozens sick. And then they went out and spread it further into the community. And I don't know if they have the total death toll, but this one guy accidentally killed a bunch of people. And the people that he infected, they didn't know that they were infected and they continued to spread it. So
it's
not a matter of like, you know, you might say, look, I'm brave enough to go out there into the world, and if I start getting sick, well, I'll certainly be responsible and stay home, but you might not know you're sick. And that's, you know, that's where I said on Dave's show, that's where the devil himself came in and edited the genetic code of this thing with H1N1 and SARS and all those, even though SARS, you know, was spreading and killing thousands of people. I knew just from reading the news that essentially you can't spread this thing unless you have a fever. And that means that it can be contained. Like Ebola, it's bad, but it can be contained. But as soon as I saw I was reading the Wall Street Journal about this thing, I think it could have been January, but certainly in February, that this thing can be spread by people before they know they're sick. Well, No fever checkpoint in the world can stop that. So it's coming this way, and nobody can stop it. And you have people, and you know, we're all about the non-aggression principle, but aggression usually is pretty simply defined: force, theft, or fraud. But what about accidentally infecting strangers? You know,
that's what I was speculating about on Pete Canona's podcast.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, how do we factor in the non-aggression principle to this? If you are aware of the existence of a virus like this, that's transmitted like this, that can be transmitted inadvertently. I mean, it'd be one thing if you went out there and said, I have AIDS and I'm going to try to infect as many people as possible. Then we clearly see that's a form of aggression. But in this case, as you say, you could be going around unwittingly infecting people. But then suppose there's some treatment. Now, dare I say vaccine? Well, that, of course, opens up a million other cans of worms. But just for the sake of argument, assume there are no problems with the vaccine. There are no side effects. There's no moral issues involved in it. And it's a simple, simple procedure that you can take that would avoid this, that would prevent you from inadvertently infecting people. And you just refuse to take it. In Ancapistan, would we let you just wander around?
Right. Well, good question. And, you know, of course, the anti-vax people would say, well, if you're vaccinated, what do you care? But there are going to always be people, even with the ideal vaccine, who can't take it. My wife, for example, is allergic to eggs. Well, that precludes about 90% of all vaccines. She can't take them because they're almost all grown in chicken eggs.
Ah, I didn't even know about that. I didn't think of that.
You know, there's always going to be things like that. And, you know, same thing with, you know, you got a kid who just got treatment for blood cancer, right? And then, so their immune system is depressed. So they can't take a vaccine because the vaccine itself would be dangerous to them because of the chemo or whatever. There's a million exceptions. So then all those people are the ones who are at risk from the person who refuses to take it. But then, as you're implying here, so who do we hire to inject them? The sheriff, right, or the National Guard, right? We're not in a very good position to do anything about that without, endorsing aggression that was some kind of coercion that we otherwise would never endorse.
So, well, then you've got this proposal that we're going to go and try and figure out who's had it already and presumably has immunity, and then we'll let those people go to work. So you're telling me They're gonna try to do tests on hundreds of millions of people? Is that the plan?
No.
I mean, that's what the best they've come up with? So what is the plan?
Yeah. They don't have one. I mean, that's the whole thing about it. You know, I saw on Tucker Carlson the other night, he interviewed a guy from a company who had imported the technology from Germany to come up with a very quick, easy, simple, and cheap antibody test to see who's already had it. And that this could be widespread. I'm talking 3 days ago, Tom, right? So April the 5th, I think, April 6th episode, something like that. And the FDA won't let them do it. The FDA is still dragging ass and won't let them develop and spread the vaccine. And the guy just shrugs to Tucker Carlson. I don't know, man. I'm waiting for him to cut the red tape, but they just won't do it. And he doesn't know when they'll let his company get to work saving people's lives. And this is what we've got to know. This is one of the big arguments, right, is whether maybe this thing has been spreading pretty wild since January, and maybe we already have herd immunity in some places. Maybe that's why in some places it would be better to not have a clamp down and go ahead, I mean, for the disease even, never mind the economy and the suicide rate and the collateral damage, but even for the disease itself, maybe it would be better to have herd immunity. Maybe we already have achieved it in some places, and maybe the lockdown is short-circuiting that, but we don't know that, and we can't know that until we at least can have good samples of, you know, area samples, if not widespread for everyone. At least, you know, we're going to test the entire north side of this county and extrapolate from there or whatever it is.
Yeah, maybe that.
But that's not happening either. And, you know, as far as back to libertarianism here, you know, people are saying, in fact, I saw this morning Elizabeth Warren had a tweet that said Ronald Reagan said that the scariest words in the English language were, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you. But now we know that that's not true. The scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and there's a major crisis and I don't have a plan and I don't know what to do. And So, you know what? They make sure to stay in the way. It's not like they'll go ahead and drown themselves in the Atlantic Ocean so that we can figure it out for ourselves. They do everything they can to obstruct.
Yeah,
unless they're in control of the test. They don't want you to take it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this whole hydroxychloroquine thing, I mean, obviously I'm not in a position to evaluate that. But obviously, yeah, I know they haven't done formal clinical trials. Yeah, no kidding. But there are physicians all over the place with no particular axe to grind who are getting on TV and saying, look, this is helping my patients a lot. And I am of the opinion that, because I had my friend, I was on with my friend Roger McCaffrey, and he said, the New York Times has all these doctors spooked because they know that if they say anything, they're going to be called quacks, and they're just anecdotal, and you got to ignore them and whatever. They have made the atmosphere impossible, but yet these doctors keep coming out with it, keep coming out with it. If it were up to me, if I were Trump, I would take a few of these doctors who've had good results with it. I'd put them on the damn coronavirus update pressers, and that would be to reassure doctors in the country, you're not crazy. And you're not going to be demonized and condemned. And if it turns out that this stuff really, really is helping the way they say it is, then I don't see how Trump loses re-election. These people, they hate me so much that they just knew that this drug wouldn't work? None of these people are experts. They don't know anything. They just wanted to make sure you couldn't have it. And some of these governors banned it because they wanted to stick it to me.
Yep.
And it turns out it saves people's lives. If that's not a winner, then he can't ever win.
Yeah. Well, look who he's up against. He's probably assured a win anyway at this point. But yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, I mean, some of these doctors, I've seen them where they explain how it works, too, that the chloroquine opens up the cell and allows the zinc in, and then the zinc prevents the virus from taking root. I'm not saying I know that that's true, but I'm saying they seem to know that that's how it works. They're not just saying, well, I don't know, when I mix green and blue together, it seems to work okay. You know, they have an idea of what they're doing, and it's based on previous experience with using this drug and others for other, you know, lung infections in the past. So And then the third magic ingredient, they say you need a good Z-Pak in there. And even though that's an antibacterial, that prevents secondary infection, but also it has whatever other qualities that they say help with this too. So, you know, and then I've noticed, I'm sure you've noticed too, that when they debunk it, all they say is, like you were saying, oh, boo-hoo, there's no double-blind controlled study here, and then they just leave it at that. And, you know, yesterday Trump said, well, I think you're supposed to use it with zinc. And they have a story in the New York Times about, well, we don't know where he's getting that. Well, but I do. It was doctors who said that is where he's getting that. And they don't even, you know, pretend to say, well, the argument is that the zinc would work this way, but we don't believe that. They just pretend that they don't even know what the argument is at all. Maybe they don't. And all they need to know is, until it's published in JAMA, forget about it. And the fact that this is an emergency where timeliness is extremely relevant doesn't seem to interfere with their thinking on it. As you said, they've got an axe to grind, and that goes first, even at the expense of innocent civilian lives.
See, I can't imagine ever being in a situation where this is going on under Obama. And he has said a few times, I think we're hearing some promising things about a particular drug. Not that it's a miracle cure, but we're hearing some promising things about a particular drug. I just can't imagine, Scott, ever thinking, don't you take that drug. That hasn't been tested. Don't you take that drug. And anybody talking about this drug is some kind of a quack. I can't imagine ever being that way.
Yep. Well, that's why you don't write for the New York Times, Tom. And, you know, the New York Times, they had an article slamming this, like an op-ed slamming this on, I don't know if it was the same day or it was the next day after they had run a hard news piece saying that actually some doctors are claiming to get some really good results out of this and giving it perfect credibility. You know, the opinion page doesn't read the news section and don't even know that they're contradicting their own reporting there. So, but yeah, these are the guys who are calling the shots. I don't know. Hey, y'all, check it out.
The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews, 2004 through 2019. Interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the good doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. Hey, you guys may know I'm involved in some Libertarian Party politics this year, but you can't hear or read about that at the Libertarian Institute due to 501c3 rules and such. So make sure to sign up for the interviews feed at scotthorton.org and keep an eye on my blog at scotthorton.org/stress. Hey y'all, Scott here. If you want a real education in history and economics, you should check out Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Tom and a really great group of professors and experts have put together an entire education of everything they didn't teach you in school but should have. Follow through from the link in the margin at scotthorton.org for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom.
Well, I guess, you know, we already kind of talked about, you know, who's to decide where, you know, I'm deciding for my family. And as I said, because my wife is sick, I'm deciding that we're all locked down. I don't need anybody to tell me to be locked down. I was saying that long before the city of Austin or the state of Texas did. You know, I have my own rules there. So in a sense, my bias is toward not minding this stuff so much because it's not really changing what I'm doing anyway. But that's not the question of whether I like it or not. It's, you know, how other people having to deal with this. I'm not trying to decide for others. But
right. And so this is why it kind of bothers me, actually, when people say, you know, this really isn't so bad. I'm getting to spend more time with my kids. I'm doing some gardening. I'm catching up on some books I've been meaning to get to. I'm getting some projects done around the house. You know, house arrest, you could say the same thing about house arrest, you know, but you'd be an idiot to talk that way. And so likewise, I don't want to live like that because I travel a lot. I love traveling. I'm on the go all the time and I love that. But I wouldn't say that anybody who doesn't want to live like me is just a Philistine who doesn't understand the value of life the way I'm kind of being lectured to by these people. Well, you can live a very fulfilling life staying in your house all the time. You know, this is not the time to have that conversation.
Yeah.
You know, when the gun is away from my head, then we'll talk about whose lifestyle is preferable. But yeah, to be sitting there saying, well, you know, actually, it's not so bad. No.
Well,
even if
so,
it weren't
would
so
you
bad,
concede,
I am not conceding that now.
So would you concede it to the mayor, if not the governor, or the governor, if not the president, to decide? And I guess within a realm of something that seems reasonable, like, yeah, you're under house arrest for 6 weeks, but not 18 months.
And we are going to have, and we're going to tell you what the metrics are that we're using to decide. So whether it's hospitalization, it can't be, quote, new cases, because that's a BS number that doesn't mean anything. Because that just means more testing or whatever. I want to know hospitalizations. How many people are seriously ill because of this specific thing? Maybe it's that number. Maybe it's the number of deaths. Something that we can genuinely measure. I want to know what it is and not just say, well, we're going to evaluate it according to some arbitrary undisclosed criteria every 8 weeks.
Right.
No.
When it comes to the president or the governor or the mayor or the town council or something, are you closer power is safer, you think, to trust with a decision like this?
I mean, certainly I don't want – it's amazing. People are clamoring for the president to clamp the whole country down.
Yeah. You know, the liberals are mad that he won't nationalize all industry, you know, because he's literally Hitler, but he won't follow through on all the Hitlerian controls that they desire.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And he said, and, you know, he's not a big constitutionalist, Trump, you know, but he said, well, we have a thing called, I'm not going to clamp down. because it's up to the states, because we have something called a constitution, and I cherish that. And I thought, okay, I don't think he's a constitutional scholar, but that is actually the correct answer. It turns out he stumbled into the correct answer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I got to say that the whole idea from the left, well, not, I shouldn't say the left, from the liberals, that, you know, the problem with this guy is not his, for example, refusal to do what it takes to cut the red tape at the CDC and the FDA so that people can go about doing the right thing to help each other in this crisis. But instead, they want to say he must nationalize the auto industry and force them to convert all their factories to ventilator, you know, factories and this kind of deal. That is pretty nuts. I mean, I know it's kind of nuts to ask for consistency from a liberal, but GM and I think Ford, if not Chrysler, they already were tooling up to make ventilators anyway. They figure it's good public relations for them, if nothing else, that, you know, when push comes to shove, we stop making trucks and we start making ventilators because we love you so much. You know, that's their thing. And so it's totally unnecessary anyway, but they just can't stand to see power unexercised, you know? It's funny.
Yeah. It's
even
true.
In the hands of their enemy, and not just, you know, a Republican, but the evil Donald Trump, the Russian-backed Hitler, racist, whatever guy who's here to overthrow our entire system in favor of a fascist state. But I guess they don't know what fascism means, and so they don't mind begging for it.
It's a bizarre thing. We could just hope that this subsides to the point where I don't have to deal with people like this anymore. It's amazing how I, when I posted about the 18-month proposal, I actually had a handful of people saying, well, yeah, of course we have to do that. And you know, and you're a denialist and this and that. And they had all the crazy Orwellian names for me. And I just thought, man, I mean, it's amazing to me how quickly people are ready to just do what they're told. You know, you want me to do this? I'll do this. You want me to do that? I'll do that. You want me to cancel this? I'll cancel this. You want me to not live? You want me to basically not live for a year and a half?
Yeah.
I'll do that. And if after a year and a half you say it's another year and a half, well, you're just trying to keep me safe. Jeez, I mean, if I were ruling over people, I'd want to rule over people just like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, Deist was saying on the show a minute ago, ask somebody to stay in their nice suburban house where they have enough of everything. That's already, you know, pretty stressful and asking a lot. But asking people to live in their tiny one-bedroom apartments in a high-rise with, you know, in a poorer part of town where they don't even have a decent grocery store. At best, they've got, you know, the local 7-Eleven or something in the neighborhood. And they're supposed to live like that for 18 months?
Yeah.
Stacked on top of each other in little boxes like that? That's it. Well, it's just not going to work, right?
Yeah.
You know, people are going to go. People are going to get violent as hell before they allow that to continue much longer. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that's really the maybe the equation that we need to be focused on the most, right? The will of the government to keep everything clamped down up against the will, not of the working people of America, but the business owners of America, who are the ones who have the most sway over their governments and how long they are going to tolerate this. You know, I mentioned the Wall Street Journal. I was reading that at the beginning of all of this, and that was why I was taking it seriously, because they were, and I don't mean the editorial page. I don't read the editorial page, but I just mean the hard news section. They were saying, hey, guys, this thing can be spread without a fever. You need to start laying off employees and buying gold and getting ready because this thing is coming, and you know, we're taking it very seriously. And I think that's why big business has gone along, and for that matter, medium-sized business has gone along with this, is because the journal says that, yeah, it's really worth it, right? But at some point they're going to see the diminishing returns here and they're going to start bucking. And you know, I don't know how many of the state governors are Republicans or not. I would imagine they would be somewhat more responsive to those kind of pressures. But that's what I'm counting on to be, you know, the countervailing force here, is it won't be reason that gets through to them. It'll just be political pressure by those who finance their campaigns that we've had it with this, figure out something else, you know?
And, you know, meanwhile, we've got, I'm just seeing some polling data. This Dr. Fauci, who just, I don't know, I mean, it must just be me. I can't stand the sight of this guy. I can't even talk about this guy.
Frankly, I don't pay enough attention to the TV to know, but
Oh, no. And he's all over social media and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I know
who you mean, but yeah.
80% of Americans approve of him. Because I guess because he's a doctor.
When he speaks with certainty.
Yeah, but it's the things that he's so certain about, he's not certain about the next day.
Yeah. Well, that's different.
and he'll say, no, we don't have any treatments. But what about no. Well, okay, well, is it promising? I mean, like, do you just, even anecdotally, we need something right now because, you know, my wife's dying. I mean, something. I mean, it's just amazing. I find him absolutely off-putting, the exact kind of bureaucrat with a clipboard of the priestly class who's looking down on you with his models and how superior he feels to you and how you're just going to have to abandon this and that social practice. And you're just going to – and then this is – and whatever the most pessimistic possible outcome is, he immediately adopts it. I cannot stand this guy.
Yeah.
And 80% of Americans just love him.
Yep. Well, and boy, I don't know if you saw the poll numbers in The Atlantic where you must have seen the thing where the Harvard professor was calling for a fascist totalitarian dictatorship. Did you see that?
It wouldn't be the first time.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. But it was, we need a common.
Oh, I know the article you're talking about. Yeah, I forget the wording.
Yeah, and he's saying essentially that where the preamble of the Constitution says that the goal is to secure domestic tranquility, that's all you need to know. That's the Constitution right there.
The preamble. The preamble, which is not binding on anyone. And right. The preambles were always known to not just be descriptive. They're not binding in any way.
Yeah. And by the way, I really encourage people to read that. I'll Google up the title for you here in a second. But you should read, everyone listening, you should read the entire thing because it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. By the time you get to the 2000th word, it's just absolutely unbelievable in there. His attacks on the very concept of human liberty as being not just outdated, but false all along, you know, it's just nuts to read. But then, so that started, I'm not sure if that's what started, but they started having a debate about the Constitution in The Atlantic. Randy Barnett wrote a thing and a couple other things. And there was a group of professors who wrote up how they did this poll. And they're on our side, you know, they were, you know, worried about this. They weren't looking for an excuse. They were, you know, seeing how far the bad guys might be able to go right now. And Americans answered that they are for banning Americans from being able to come home from overseas. They are for the government being able to seize any business that they wish on behalf of the coronavirus effort. They are for, and this is in huge numbers, 60s and 70s percent, and solid majorities, left and right, Democrat and Republican, in the answers, that they are for conscripting healthcare workers and to force them to work in this crisis, even at risk to their own health. And therefore the government locking people in jail for spreading things that might be misinformation about the crisis. Now, my old buddy, Rick would have said that, well, they're just scared. You know, you got to be sympathetic toward them, that this, they're afraid. And so it's easy to put words in their mouth like that. But God dang, man, I don't care how afraid I am. You're never going to get me to answer like that. Like, no. How in the world are these our countrymen that they're willing to say, yes, enslave nurses? And if they don't like it, they shouldn't have become a nurse then. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I know.
It's just. Yeah, these are our next door neighbors, man. These are their. This is.
I love how, on the one hand, they want to treat these people like they are gods,
mm-hmm.
and then on the other hand, they want to treat them like they're nothing.
Right.
Like that. They can be conscripted like they're just a thing, like an mm-hmm. object to be used.
Well, you know, this happens with the soldiers too, where they're idolized so much that in a way they're dehumanized. Right. Where if you make them a hero, it's the same thing as just calling them the N-word all day. Now it's OK to violate their rights because there's something outside of the regular human experience. And so if you have to throw their lives away, it's not the same as if that had to happen to you or me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a crazy thing, the social psychology in a time like this, man. And so you have this guy Fauci, who you hate so much, and he's got, you know, extremely receptive ears to whatever kind of ad hoc idea he can come up with. But, you know, I guess I'll leave you with, I guess, a request to the audience for suggestions about which part of the business press is really covering what the CEOs think about all this stuff and how long they're willing to put up with this kind of lockdown. And I hate to say it because I think they're the only ones who can ever break it. And while at the same time, I guess I admit that I don't know what might happen if, you know, if it very well could be right that Fauci is right, that if we lift the thing and people start going back to work, that we're going to have major spikes again and it's going to be that much worse and more thousands of innocent people are going to die and these kinds of things. So, you know, I always default against government action of any kind. Of course, you won't find me supporting what they're doing in any way. But, you know, I guess I am a bit apprehensive about what would happen if everybody just went back now, right when we're trying to flatten the thing, and then we cause a big spike in it. I know that a lot of hospitals and a lot of places are up against the limit, if not over it yet. So I don't know. What a mess.
I know. It is a mess. And now every governor is terrified because if they loosen up a little bit and there's even a little bit of a spike, then every single death is their fault,
right,
is the way people will look at it.
Yep. Well, on the other hand, they've got to know that if we're living through a real Great Depression come next election, that they're going to be out on their ass for that, too. You know, one way or the other, they're going to have to figure out how to balance this thing as best they can anyway. Which is not very well, I don't think.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
So to the point about, you know, the libertarian moment here, this is where I was trying to go with that Elizabeth Warren thing earlier, right, is that there's a consensus building that, yeah, see, you need government for all of this stuff. Meanwhile, we do have a lot, and we talked a little bit about the different examples of the way the CDC and the FDA have screwed everything up. We didn't mention all the big pharmaceutical companies and the insurance cartel and the hospital cartel and all of the ways that the healthcare system is rigged against the customer, i.e. sick patients, in the first place here. But it does seem like, you know, clamp down or not, there's still, and people obviously can take whatever sides they want in that argument, but there's still a great opportunity here. If you listen to Rahm Emanuel or Condoleezza Rice, you never want to let a crisis go to waste. And so there's a huge opportunity here for the likes of you and me to push for an end to the American empire that wastes minimum $1 trillion a year that could be better invested here in the point of view of probably every American right now. And then also, you know, a great opportunity for us to attack this rigged crony capitalist system that we have in healthcare. People are moving further and further towards socialism. And hey, 10 million something people just lost their job and their health insurance. So there are going to be a lot of desperate people not knowing what to do in the middle of this crisis. No money, and they lost their Blue Cross too, and all of that kind of thing. And so it's an opportunity for us to come up with the very best answers and solutions to those problems, and, you know, to seize this moment as proof that actually the libertarians were right all along, at the very least, about a great many things, even if we don't have, you know, the complete answer.
The thing is, they don't – that's the thing. They don't have the complete answer either.
Right.
You know, and so sometimes because we are dissidents, we are treated with some kind of – according to some standard that they would never apply to themselves.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know the exact precise answer to this. I've got some broad ideas, but neither do they. They can't give us a date. They don't know what the metrics are. They're shutting things down completely arbitrarily that obviously have nothing to do with the virus. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have the ability to take a billy club and beat people to death for disobeying you, yeah, you can get stuff done. I mean, you know, that's not particularly impressive, but you're right. We can also show that at every turn, they've had to suspend or abolish this or that rule and regulation all the time because of trying to get something done medically that changes things 3% is impossible, cannot happen under the current system.
Right.
You have to fight and struggle and fight and struggle, or you have to know somebody who knows somebody. Like, I mean, for instance, I know somebody whose son was dying of a rare form of leukemia that almost never occurs in children. But there was a promising drug that had amazing results for adults, absolutely astonishing, but hadn't been tested for children. But the kid was going to die. And so, well, we want to try the drug because he has no hope without it. It was only because my friend knew somebody who knew a former U.S. president who then got on the phone and said, give the kid that drug.
Wow. Yeah, that's totally nuts. And what a perfect example of why it should not be that way at all. And especially the FDA. I mean, the CDC, they screwed up so badly with the tests and everything. But the FDA, they still won't let you use the right tests that people want to use. I mean, they're still getting in the way as much as they possibly can, protecting their own little fiefdoms at the expense of the American people. And, you know, on the foreign policy thing, every special interest in America is trying to exploit this crisis so they can have their way. Well, you know what? How about us in the anti-war movement? All we want out of it is, I mean, hell, speaking for antiwar.com, I'm just trying to put myself out of business here. You know, it seems I don't have anything to gain. I have everything to lose. But if I could get the American people to agree with me that enough is enough already with the wars, who in the world could believe that this is, yes, what we should have been doing the last 20 years in the middle of this crisis when we don't have enough hospital beds and we don't have enough doctors and we don't have enough masks and the rest of this? You know, seems like if there's a crisis us libertarians can exploit for our own ends, ending the American empire in the interests of the American people ought to be a pretty easy sell at this point.
I would hope so. But what I can say is for sure, somebody in our ranks has to write the definitive book about this when this is over. Because
oh,
you already
I thought you were
no,
saying about the
be
wars.
Me.
I'm sorry, Tom, I'm working on it. But yeah, no, about the virus.
No,
yeah,
that one's already being done. But honestly, because it's like when I wrote Meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what the conventional wisdom would be.
Right.
Oh, well, we didn't regulate the economy enough. That kind of thing. You can already see we came to the rescue. We saved the day. Maybe it did. Maybe it didn't. I think a lot of these questions are still unanswered. There's a lot of propaganda out there. There's a guy on Twitter I like a lot, and he was actually just profiled on FoxNews.com the other day, but I already knew about him. Former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I've been looking at some of his stuff.
I'm not totally on board with him because his key book is about how marijuana can make your kids psychotic, and I have to say I'm a skeptic on that one.
Me too.
But he's been darn good on this, and he's got so much good material.
Yeah.
He
and
could make
you know
a book
what? That's
that
not
no
disqualifying
time.
Because, in fact, the greatest Western reporter in the world, Patrick Coburn, thinks that too, and wrote a book about it because his son got schizophrenia and he blamed the weed. But boy, I'll look the other way on that because Patrick Coburn is absolutely the very best guy we've got when it comes to the wars. So that error alone is not dispositive.
Right. Yeah, agreed. I don't even care at this point. But somebody's got to do it and just relentlessly smash and smash. Because there are things that people were fully on board for at the beginning that then years later they look back on it and they say, so everybody just about was rah-rah for the war on terror. And now we look back on it and say, oh, that's stupid. Is that still thing going on? Like, I mean, is that stupid thing still happening? You know, whatever it was, you look back on it and you say, maybe I shouldn't. Yep. I want this to be one of those.
I think that's a great idea, and that's a call to action to people listening too. If you think that you're the one who's really up for it, and maybe you are. And maybe you're the guy we need, or woman.
Yeah, it ain't Woods. Okay, I've hung up my writing pen permanently. But somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, and it ain't me because I'm still trying to knock out the book from the last war.
Yeah, do not distract Scott from his work that he should be doing.
That's right. And believe me, I'm spending all weekend writing on that thing this weekend. No more virus news for at least 2 days for me.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Hey, thanks so much, Tom, for doing this, man. It's been great to talk to you, bud.
Thanks a lot, Scott. We'll see you.
All right, you guys. That is the great Tom Woods. Of course, he's the host of the Tom Woods Show, and he wrote a bunch of great books, including, as he just mentioned, Meltdown, the definitive take on the crash of 08. And check out the Tom Woods Show and all of his blogs. Sign up for his email list, and all of that stuff is at tomwoods.com.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.